Regardless of the outcome in Iowa tonight, the Democratic and Republican parties both have struggles ahead, according to a new book called The Lost Majority, which frames this election year in terms of the fact that neither party can claim majority support in this country. The author is Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst for the website Real Clear Politics. Sean, your book is really interesting. Welcome to WNYC.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
You write that President Obama did not put together a new electoral coalition in 2008, despite many pundits saying that he did. He won with actually a narrower version of the Clinton coalition, you say. Can you explain that?
That's right. If you look at Bill Clinton, if you look at the map from 1996 and the map from 2008, they're actually fairly similar maps. The big wins that Obama collected were North Carolina, Virginia, and Indiana. But in truth, those three states were actually pretty close in 1996. The big difference is that Obama got blown out in the kind of Appalachian area where Bill Clinton held serve pretty well. Bill Clinton won Kentucky and Tennessee and Missouri and, of course, his home state of Arkansas, whereas Obama lost those states by double digits. And so what Obama did was take the areas of the country that Bill Clinton won and actually kind of cut some areas out, but he went deeper into areas that other areas that Bill Clinton did well in.
When you say deeper, meaning he got a bigger turnout in those areas?
That's exactly right. And he did better. I mean, Bill Clinton is the first Democrat in the post-war years to really break through in the suburbs. And Barack Obama took those suburban victories of Bill Clinton, built on them, and racked up even larger margins in places like Fairfax County, Virginia. Also, the minority vote obviously had a surge in turnout in support of the first African-American presidential nominee. Those were areas where Bill Clinton did well, but didn't get quite the turnout that Barack Obama was able to achieve.
Does this inform the eternal debate over whether candidates should appeal to swing voters or just appeal strongly to their bases? You know, we hear this on both sides, whether a candidate should be pure, because then those who really feel passionately about the kinds of things that he or she stands for will turn out in great numbers, and that's really the key to winning elections, as opposed to trying to appeal to swing voters by being more moderate, more toward the center from either direction, but leaving some of your most passionate potential supporters home?
Actually, President Obama speaks to the danger of the base strategy. If you follow the Gallup tracking poll subdata, the crosstabs, the demographic breakdowns carefully in 2008, you see that Barack Obama was having some real problems with swing voters up until the financial collapse. That's what really finally brought the white working class on board and college-educated whites. If you look even before the convention start, the day the Democratic convention started in 2008, the candidates were knotted up. So even in kind of a perfect storm election for the Democrats, Barack Obama was in some trouble before Lehman Brothers collapsed.
Your book is also historical. It goes all the way back to the pre-FDR days. And so from your point of view, just as you say, the Obama coalition wasn't historic in the way that some people have portrayed it. You also say that for all we talk about the Reagan coalition after his two victories, you see that is overblown, with history underestimating the Eisenhower coalition as the basis of the modern Republican Party, correct?
That's absolutely right. When people talk about the Reagan coalition, they talk about Reagan Democrats who were kind of white working class voters who were disaffected by the Great Society, and suburbanites and Southerners. But if you go back to 1952, those were the areas where Eisenhower broke through. He racked up huge majorities in the suburbs, and he was the first Republican ever, well, except for Herbert Hoover in a strange election in 1928. Eisenhower was the first Republican to come close to carrying the South. He almost won a majority of Southerners' votes way back in 1952. Add in white working class voters. My grandparents, who are diehard Democrats, voted for Eisenhower. And that's really the basis of the modern Republican Party, Nixon's coalition and Reagan's.
But how would you describe the Republican coalition today? When we think of the Eisenhower era, we don't think of, you know, what Democrats at least would consider the hard edge of the Pat Robertson religious right or the Paul Ryan Tea Party.
Well, remember, a lot of those issues hadn't come to the forefront yet. There was no culture war in 1952. It was brewing, but, the status quo normalcy kind of ruled. And the 1960s upset that balance and caused the two parties to coalesce in two different camps on that. Similarly, if you look at the Republican Party today, it really doesn't attack the New Deal nearly as much as it attacks the Great Society. I mean, Social Security, there have been, George W. Bush had a small attempt to start minor private accounts. But other than that, there's no large-scale pushes along the Barry-Goldwater lines to completely do away with the program. It's the Great Society programs, the transfer payments, things like welfare that really draw the Republicans' ire.
But including Medicare, which is such a big issue, and that was a Great Society program.
That's true. And if you look at Medicare, Medicare is kind of in the same vein as Social Security. And the Ryan plan is really kind of a new step, and it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out, the attempt to turn Medicare into a privatized program. It's something that the Times possibly, arguably call for, but it's a really polarizing issue that could damage the Republican coalition.
Sean Trendy from Real Clear Politics, author of The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. We can take some phone calls for him at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, on the nature of what makes up the National Democratic Coalition, National Republican Coalition in America today in this presidential election year, where both candidates will be trying to maximize those coalitions once the Republicans have a nominee. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692, or go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehr Show. So, Sean, for all we talk about gridlock and entrenched polarization, we keep seeing power change hands, which is part of the core of your book. The Republicans won the presidency in both houses of Congress as recently as 2004. The Democrats then took Congress in 2006 and the presidency in 2008. The Republicans took Congress back in 2010. Does it mean there really is a meaningful block of independent voters who swing back and forth?
Absolutely, and that's been the rule in American history, in part because the parties are pretty smart. They do a good job of adapting to the other party's weaknesses. And once you take universal power, you have to start making choices between members of your coalition. We remember things like the Terry Schiavo vote that pleased the religious right base of the Republican Party, but didn't run so well in the suburbs. Similarly, you have.
I think that was the beginning of the end of the Bush coalition, by the way. That was right after the reelection in 2004. And Terry Schiavo and the attack on Social Security with the small private accounts that came about the same time and really started to sink the Republican coalition in the eyes of the public. I don't know if you agree.
I absolutely agree. And there were things like, the Republican Party, actually, a lot of the compassionate conservatism of George W. Bush was an attempt to swing minority voters over. But the deficits that came as a result of it did a lot to weaken the Republican Party in the suburbs, where you kind of have fiscally conservative, socially moderate voters. Mm-hmm. You then add things like Terry Schiavo on top of that. And that's a large part of why Barack Obama was able to run so incredibly well in the suburbs. It was kind of a perfect storm for the Democrats in 2008. Then you have things like the health care bill, which, were perceived as a big spending program that kind of pushed the suburbs back the other way.
So why don't we have a centrist third party in this country?
Because the major parties are smart. It's just what I talked about, that the parties adapt and will those suburban voters who get pushed out of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party comes back and it has an election where it doesn't emphasize the social issues. It emphasizes the economic issues that appeal to them. Now, once they get into power and have control of Congress and the presidency, they have to start picking and choosing and narrowing their coalition, and then the Democrats respond. What we've seen again and again in this country is that when third-party movements gain steam, their messages are always co-opted by one of the two major parties. It happened with Ross Perot with his focus on the deficit. It happened with George Wallace and his focus on, quite frankly, on segregation and the Great Society. And we even saw it in the 1880s with the populists.
How do you see the Tea Party in that context?
Well, you already see it being co-opted by the Republican Party. The Tea Party grew out of a sense that the Republican parties had been big spending conservatives in the 2000s, and that then the Democrats came in and were even bigger spending. And so you saw the Republican Party's message shift to take advantage of the Tea Party movement's energy, and it became more of a traditionally fiscally conservative party in the 2010 elections.
Do you think that by that analysis, the fact that the purist Tea Party wing captured so much power would be bad for the GOP in the long run because they're going to be seen as too extreme by people in the suburbs who I think you're framing as the big swing voters?
It is very, the suburbanites and I think the white working class as well could be turned off by severe fiscal rectitude when the Republican Party comes into power. And that's just it. If the Republicans have a big win in 2012, which I think is very much possible, a win on the order of Barack Obama and the Democrats win in 2008, they're going to have to start making choices. Do they really mean it when they say they're going to enact the Ryan plan? Well, if they do, it'll please their Tea Party base, but, you know, moderate suburbanites and white working class voters who depend on these social spending programs, these middle class welfare programs, quite frankly, are going to have a fit. And then the Democrats will be perfectly positioned to bounce back in 2014.
Bob in Mountainside, you're on WNYC with Sean Trendy from Real Clear Politics. Hello.
Well, happy New Year, and thanks for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thanks. I'm wondering, what would be what do you expect if for some reason Ron Paul wins the Republican nomination? Do you think that he would pull a lot of the people, the anti-war vote from President Obama, considering that he basically continued on with President Bush's policies?
Well, Happy New Year to you as well. I think that a Ron Paul nomination, I think it's unlikely, but if he were to become the nominee, you would see a big shift in the coalitions of the parties. The ACLU recently had a scorecard where it rated Ron Paul better than it rated President Obama. And there was a time when the left was actually, at the beginning of the 20th century, when the left was split between the two parties. The left was the swing vote. If Ron Paul were the nominee, we could see some severe changes in the party coalition with a large number of liberals and social libertarians coming over to the Republican Party, whereas maybe you see some people who are traditionally in the Republican Party who think that Barack Obama is actually a better choice than Ron Paul. Very interesting election.
Bill in Fairhaven, you're on WNYC. Hi, Bill.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. This is sort of a generic question to any author of political books, but when I listen to your show, I always wondering, you know, I wonder, you know, where the author is. Is he leaning right? Is he leaning left? Is he in the middle? And how do authors like himself sort of try to keep his personal views out of the data?
Well, I think there's a difference between being conservative and being a conservative. I'm almost certainly not a conservative. I think if you had to pin me down, both sides would find plenty of things to like. I don't know how you describe a guy who's fiscally conservative but pro-gay marriage. Maybe you'd say I have libertarian inclinations. As far as keeping them out of the book, I think, it's like being a sports writer. Everyone who follows sports has their team that they root for. But at the end of the day, you have to learn to train yourself to kind of call your shots carefully and to not always go in for the team you like. And that's certainly the case with this book.
Well, it depends what business you think you're in, right? I mean, I couldn't have told from the parts of your book that I read closely what your political leanings are, and I don't know if you disclose in the book even as much as you just disclosed to our caller. But there are political writers who are in the business of expressing their opinions, trying to convince people of their opinions, or trying to convince people to their parties or their candidates, and there are those who are just trying to do a completely nonpartisan, non-agenda-driven analysis. So to the caller as well, it really depends what you think people are trying to do.
That's right. I mean, there's authors, you know, Ann Coulter and on the right, and Al Franken on the left, who, you know, they're polemicists and they're trying to convince people of a certain point of view. And I'm not trying to do that politically speaking. Like I said, it helps. I mean, when I was in Virginia in the last 6 elections, I voted for 3 Republicans, 2 Democrats, and 1 I couldn't stand either, so I abstained. So it kind of helps that I am more of a swing voter. Mm-hmm. But yeah, that's exactly right. Try to call it as I see it.
All right. Bill, thank you for your call. And this is Sean Trendy. That's Trendy with an E at the end of his name, not a Y. Senior elections analyst for Real Clear Politics. He's written a book called The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. And you say the Midwest is the key swing region in the country, including Iowa, even though it's 90% white. Also, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Minnesota, Ohio, and Michigan. And it's really interesting to think Pennsylvania could elect both Rick Santorum and Ed Rendell statewide. Wisconsin, both Russ Feingold and Scott Walker. Minnesota, Tim Pawlenty and Al Franken. I mean, that's pretty schizophrenic. How do you explain it?
You know, that's a question that has flummoxed political scientists, because there is, in these states, there are pretty strong swing votes that would conceivably push the candidates toward the center. And we have seen more centrist candidates typically elected from those states than you see from a state like Vermont or a state like Georgia, which incidentally have only voted together 4 times in presidential elections since Reconstruction. But I think what you see is that the political tides shift back and forth, and the swing voters in the center of those states kind of go with the tide. So in a year like 2010, they're open to a very conservative candidate like Pat Toomey, whereas in a year like 2006, they'll swing further to the left, and you'll have, or 2008, you'll have a situation where in Minnesota, though he won very, very narrowly, Al Franken manages to upset a fairly moderate Republican.
JC in Johnsonburg, New Jersey. You're on WNYC. Hello, JC.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm very confused. I'm against abortion. I'm for amnesty. I'm against gay marriage, but I'm for gay rights. I believe we should tax the rich. How do I find the person, the right person to express these views?
What? An independent thinker. We can't have that in this country.
But, you know, how do you get your point across to these people that, you know, there's got to be some compromise on some of this stuff? Because I believe there are a lot of people who probably are in the middle like me. I really do.
Sean, advise. Poor JC.
It's tough to be in the middle and to have heterodox views, because you do have a large group on both sides in this country that kind of see things the same way. What's interesting is that, you know, maybe not 20 years ago, I mean, Bill Clinton would have kind of been in that camp. You go back 40 years ago and you would have had a Democratic Party that largely encompasses these more populist views. So I think it's a situation where the parties have kind of become polarized in a lot of ways, and in a lot of ways don't necessarily make neat ideological sense. Why is the Republican Party for government intervention in social issues but not in fiscal issues, and then vice versa? And it makes it hard, if you really have a principled view of things, to decide what party you want. you know. Stick with your guns, believe what you believe, and try to find someone that's the closest to what you believe is the only thing that I can say.
Write to the people and, you know, in Congress, and just say, you know, let's have a little compromise here.
JC, how do you like Governor Christie so far?
I like him. I think he's a very moral and strong person, and I don't mind that his views sometimes are hard, because I'm a retired educator, but I believe that he believes what he says, and he does what he says.
JC, thank you for your call. Call us again, all right?
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Good luck.
You too. And making up your mind once the Republicans have a nominee. Sean, you analyze the country's electorate in your book somewhat in terms of race, and point out how the Democrats are becoming a minority party among whites. Why do you think that is? What do whites want as a group that the Dems aren't giving them?
Well, I think, you know, talking about race is always a dicey issue. And even talking about something as broad about whites, I mean, you have very liberal whites and you have very conservative whites, just as you do with racial minorities. I think part of the issue is that the Democratic coalition, you know, the strongest Democratic coalition members are African Americans. They vote 90% typically for a Democrat, and in 2008 it was 96%. And a lot of times the interests of African Americans are opposed on economic issues, especially to those of even working class whites who perceive their tax dollars being transferred to African Americans, and same with suburbanites. And so that's what's really polarizing things. And Latino voters are a growing portion of the electorate. They're a little different than African American voters, but a lot of white voters see the same types of tensions. It's a tension that began really cropping up in our politics in 1964, and it still underlies a lot of it.
Blacks were 13% of the electorate in 2008. Latinos, I think, only about 9%, right?
That's exactly right.
Even though there are now more Latinos than blacks in the population as a whole. And since Asians are even fewer, that means the overall vote in 2008 was still about 75% white, even as the population changes. How different do you think that'll be this year?
I'm not convinced it's going to be all that different. The African-American share of the electorate is typically 10 to 11%. There was a big boost for Obama in 2008 because of enthusiasm about making history. I'm not sure the same level of enthusiasm is there, and I think you'll probably see something that's a little bit more akin to the 10, 11% turnout, maybe 12, than the 13 that was achieved in 2008.
And you warn Democrats not to take Latinos for granted, because as they become more affluent, their economic interests are going to line up more with Republican positions. But the Republicans keep insisting on throwing Latinos under the bus to favor white resentment, I think. Just last week, you probably noticed this, Romney announced that he would veto the DREAM Act if Congress were to pass it, the DREAM Act which would allow children brought here illegally to become citizens if they grow up to go to college or into the military. If he makes a big show of announcing he would veto that, and he's the nominee, he's more anti-Latino than President Bush was or John McCain was, who both promoted a path to citizenship, so-called comprehensive immigration reform, and even they only got a third of the Latino vote.
Yeah, you know, the trick is with Latino voters, immigration issues are not as important to them as many people make it out to be. If you look at the 2008 exit polls, 54% of Latino voters either said immigration isn't an important issue to me, or it is an important issue to me, and I'm voting Republican anyway. Now, John McCain was, as you noted, further to the, I guess we would call it, left on the immigration issue, so that might have helped. But it's just not the salience that, say, civil rights issues have among the African-American community. When you look at Latino voters and polls of Latino voters this year, the top issues are the same top issues they are for white voters. It's jobs, it's the economy. And I think if Mitt Romney, assuming he's the nominee, which I think he will be, has a message that resonates on jobs in the economy, and the economy doesn't improve for President Obama, I think there's room for headway for Republicans there.
Last thing, quick little tag here on that point, then we're out of time. You seem to imply near the end of your book that Texas, stalwart, staunch Republican, right-wing Texas, may become a swing state in the not-too-distant future because of the growing Latino population. Do you mean to say that?
It's definitely a possibility, and I don't think it's accidental that, you know, George W. Bush and Rick Perry, the governors of Texas since 1994, who have run for president, have taken kind of a softer approach on immigration. The Republican Party there tends to be softer on immigration issues, and the Latino voters in Texas tend to vote more Republican than they do in a place like, say, California or Arizona.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and Perry got in trouble for it, as you know, with the Republican electorate in the primary debates. All right, Sean Trendy, senior elections analyst for Real Clear Politics. His new book, The Lost Majority, Why the Future of Government is Up for Grabs and Who Will Take It. Very interesting conversation and book. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, still to come this hour. A report on last week's elections in Jamaica, where the issues were, guess what, jobs and debt. So Jamaicans in New York, we want your voices on the air right now. call up and talk about your country of origin. Presidential elections, or really they were parliamentary elections, picking a new prime minister in Jamaica last week, 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692 for any Jamaicans listening right now. And then Jim O'Grady from our transportation website, Transportation Nation, will help us look at a ghost subway map, the lines that were imagined but never built, and the ones that were built and later dismantled. You can see that ghost subway map right now at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show.